You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, USA Today Network named Women of This Century in each state and the District of Columbia to commemorate the anniversary of women's suffrage. We'll learn about Wisconsin's top 10 list. Now, the presidential election is just over a month away, and multiple lawsuits that could affect voting are still being hashed out in the courts. The Wisconsin Supreme Court heard arguments in two of these cases yesterday. One could purge about 130,000 people from the voter registration list. The other seeks guidance on who's allowed to bypass the photo ID requirement when requesting an absentee ballot. And a federal appeals court handed down two rulings in the past 24 hours in a case determining when absentee ballots in the state can be received and counted. Sean Johnson is here to get us up to speed. He's WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, my head's spinning, Sean, with all this going on in the courts, but I'm sure you'll talk me down a little bit. Let's start with this lawsuit over when absentee ballots can be delivered and counted. Developments today on this even. What's at stake on this case?
Well, I think what's at stake in this case, big picture, is whether we have, you know, an election night, as we have historically known it in Wisconsin, or an election week. Or in previous elections, we have had to turn in, or absentee ballots have had to arrive by 8 p.m. on election night in order to be counted. And what happened in April in ruling by Judge William Conley is there was an extension. You know, people were able to, those ballots were able to be counted as long as they arrived up to 6 days after the election. Conley issued a ruling in another lawsuit this month that would do the same thing in November's election. And what happened is that got sent to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. They initially put it on hold, but then they backed off. And as of right now, that ruling would go forward and we would have this 6 day delay for ballots to be counted.
Now, who's challenging this ruling?
The Republicans, I guess, the Republican Party, the Republican National Committee, and the Republican-controlled state legislature are challenging this ruling. So they're all going after it with, you know, the political groups going at it with a slightly different approach than the state legislature. You know, they're saying that the state law should remain as it is, and they don't want the judge to be able to adjust these timelines. The lawsuit, which put this case before the judge, was brought by Democrats, Democratic groups, including the Democratic National Committee. They are very focused on making sure that it's easy to vote absentee and that absentee ballots get counted in this election as more people use that as an option in light of the spread of COVID-19.
Now, this is an appeals court. Is there a chance that this might go to, I think they usually do these as a panel, to the full appeals court or to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, I suppose there's a chance. I mean, you're talking about the like an en banc appeal, they call it, when they take it to the full appeals court. That hasn't happened yet, but I guess that is an option. There's not a lot of time here, so there is also a chance that Republicans would just try to appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court. The panel that heard it initially is not a Democratic panel of judges by any means. There are three judges appointed by Republican presidents. One of them, Judge Frank Easterbrook, who was appointed by Republican President Ronald Reagan, has, he doesn't mix his words. He's a stern guy. He handed Democrats a pretty big loss in an earlier election case this year. And so this panel doesn't seem to be budging. Republicans tried an appeal today to this panel, telling them, you know, hey, I think you should go to the state Supreme Court because this is really boiling down to a question of whether or not the Republican legislature has standing to challenge this. And the appeals court basically just ignored that and without explanation and rejected it.
Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, looking at some of the big court news in Wisconsin when it comes to elections. Let's move on now to this case on 130,000 names on Wisconsin's voter registry, whether they should stay or should go. Where is this case? What's it about?
This case is, you know, as you mentioned about this list of names, these are names that were flagged by a multi-state database of government records Where the names essentially don't match up on these government records. So they were flagged. There was mail, postcards sent to the names at these addresses saying that, you know, you've been flagged by this system. And the way that the Wisconsin Elections Commission had been handling this is that they were going to flag these names, but they were not going to remove them from the voter list until next year. So until after the November election, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative law firm, stepped in and said, you don't have that option. State law says you have to do this now. The Elections Commission disputes that. And so that's what led to this case where the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty has taken it to the state Supreme Court to try to get the court to weigh in on their side and force the Elections Commission to purge these names from the voter list.
We've heard that conservative Justice Brian Hagedorn might be a potential swing vote in this case. Why he's one of the conservative bloc generally viewed as on the court. Why might he be thought of as a potential swing vote?
Yeah, it's not like Hagedorn has joined liberals on a large number of cases, but he has joined them on some pretty high profile cases. You know, I guess one that comes to mind this year was the Safer at Home order, for example. He joined the liberal bloc. What's different now is that the court has a 4-3 conservative majority. So if Hagedorn joins the liberals, that swings the vote on an issue very likely. And on this particular case, the conservatives wanted to have an expedited hearing for this case earlier this year or last year. And Hagedorn stepped in and blocked that, basically said that it needed to go through the court system at the, through the usual channels. So he hasn't weighed in on the merits of the case by any means, but I think Hagedorn is just going to be one of those swing justices, as much as we have one in Wisconsin, particularly on a case like this.
Finally, a case on the photo ID requirement for absentee ballots. What's happening with this one?
Yeah, this one, again, kind of stems from an experience that Wisconsin had back in April, where the Dane County clerk, Scott McDonald, told voters who were housebound because of the pandemic that they could indicate they are, quote, indefinitely confined when filling out an online form to request a mail-in ballot. After indicating they're confined, voters are allowed to bypass a normal absentee ballot application requirement where they have to upload a copy of a valid ID for voting, like a driver's license. So the court back in spring told McDonald, that the advice he was giving was wrong. Essentially, this is a case that's before the court, asking the court to give guidance on how to handle indefinite confinement cases in the future, given the prospect that it might come up again as we head toward November.
And all of these cases, Sean, maybe in a normal election year is might not be such a big deal. But with tight margins in statewide elections in Wisconsin, with Wisconsin being a key state on the overall electoral college map, they're getting a lot of attention, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they're always a big deal. You know, there's always these cases that could involve a few votes here, a few thousand, a few 10,000 votes there, a few 100,000 votes there. There's always something in Wisconsin, which is, you know, as you mentioned, a swing state, a very divided state. And so the parties fight very aggressively, kind of on the margins of what ballots should count and what should not.
Sean, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief. He talked to us about three different court cases that could have an impact on the November 3rd election. You can always find updates from the WPR news team at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll talk about how clothing can send a message in politics. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up every day, we make a choice about the clothes we put on. But for politicians, their clothing usually seeks to project a certain image or message. We'll talk to a researcher about the politics of clothing. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to a question about language.
Wisconsin recently received a listener question from Catherine Bolt. She wonders, what is the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin after English and Spanish? The answer? Hmong. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy looks into why.
That was Macy Herr, the executive director of Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, introducing herself in Hmong.
So I'm Hmong American. I grew up, for the most part, in the Wausau area, attended high school there.
Herr calls herself a 1.5 generation Hmong American, meaning she moved to the United States with her parents when she was young. Many Hmong Americans who came to the United States from Southeast Asia were from isolated mountain villages in Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. recruited many Hmong people to help fight the North Vietnamese. When the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam in 1975, thousands of Hmong fled to refugee camps in Thailand and later resettled in the U.S.
There are many families that were sponsored by groups and organizations, many of them faith-based or churches specifically, in the Wisconsin area. We ended up moving to Wisconsin to be with the rest of our, or should I say, a good portion of our family in Wisconsin.
Today, about 50,000 Hmong people call Wisconsin home, making it the third largest state population in the country behind California and Minnesota. While Hmong is the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin behind English and Spanish, less than 1% of the population speaks it. UNESCO predicts the Hmong language will likely die out by the end of this century. Song Shong, executive director of Gia Shia in La Crosse, said there are several reasons for that. She spoke with me about it from home as her child played in another room.
Hmong is one of the hardest languages to learn because it's a tonal language. You know, a lot of Westerners have a hard time speaking Mandarin because it's four tones. And with Hmong, you double those, so it's eight tones.
The meaning of a word changes based on the tone used.
So, for example, if I was to say the word red in Hmong is lia. So if I say the word in different tones, it will go something like lia, 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 lia.
The different tones change the word from red to rice paddy, disgusting, and rice harvesting tool. The other four tones don't have meaning. And then Sean points to the difference between generations.
It's also a dying language because it's not being passed down at all. It's not being used. The folks that use it are our elders who don't speak any other language other than Hmong.
English is everywhere, Herr says. While she can speak Hmong conversationally, teaching it to her six-year-old son is a challenge when he's surrounded by English in school, with his friends, and on television.
I fear for myself, my own son, you know, for, as someone who values the language and the culture, it's hard to pass those things down to your child in a society where you still want them to thrive and understand the culture in which they live in.
But those hurdles don't keep Herr and Shong from being optimistic. They both organize annual Hmong language and culture camps for kids. And Herr says she sees signs of younger Hmong people looking to reclaim their heritage.
The Hmong are an indigenous group of people. You know, we don't have a home country to go back to. Whatever we can keep alive, the people, the language is so, so important.
Shong says to really keep the language alive, it will take those in the Hmong community coming together and advocating for the language to be implemented in grade schools and universities.
But most importantly, I think it takes non-Hmong folks to also support those causes. It comes from the Hmong community wanting it, and then the dominant culture, non-Hmong folks also advocating for those things as well.
WPR digital producer Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on the Hmong language, the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, if someone were to ask you what a politician dressed like, you might describe someone wearing your standard issue suit, likely gray or navy, button-up shirt, polished sensible shoes, tie, American flag lapel pin. That's the male kit, anyway. For women, there's more variety and more tough choices to make. Our next guest says clothing choices tell a story, especially when it comes to politics. And there can be a difficult balancing act that can be different for incumbents and challengers. Jo Ellen Posner is an assistant professor of management and an organizational theorist at the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara University. Jo Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What led you to want to tackle the role that clothing choices play for political figures?
I've been interested in political clothing for a long time, but actually this started with the last Republican National Convention in 2016. And there were just so many interesting, different, unexpected choices at work that we saw. And it really struck me that there wasn't necessarily a typical story being told by those clothes. And it led to several years of observation, analysis, and now some work in writing.
And you mentioned the word story, and it seems like that's a key part of your research. Above a certain level, anything a politician wears didn't happen by accident. What kind of stories do they try to tell when they select their clothing?
I think a lot of them are trying to, you know, tell us something about their personality, but also tell us something about their values. Right. I think of Jim Jordan a lot, the congressman from Ohio who never wears a jacket, carries it around. And it is kind of consistent with his wrestling background, his athletic background. And he just looks like he's ready for a fight. He's not going to be encumbered by a jacket.
And you've noticed big differences between incumbents and challengers. And you've done a recent work, especially looking at the Senate level here.
Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting to see the difference between the story that challengers are able to tell with their clothing because they're not encumbered by the constraints of their office, right? Many of them, they have jobs, but they're spending most of their time on the campaign trail where they're trying to get across a really specific message. And they're able to do that through their clothing in a way that incumbents, who mostly are working in the Senate, are not, because those folks are wearing suits, because that's what you wear to the Senate floor. And the challengers are out there, you know, wearing whatever they want to and able, therefore, to portray a really specific message about who they are, what they stand for.
You compare and contrast a couple of different races. What things did you take away from looking at three big Senate races in the country?
I think the most telling one is really the Arizona race between Martha McSally and Kelly. So Kelly's a former astronaut. He's got a military background. He's married to Gabby Giffords, and he's able to show all of that through his sartorial choices, right? He's almost never in a suit. He's in often a flight jacket, sometimes with a NASA logo. And he's really able to telegraph, these are issues that are important to me. Environmental protection, which is a big focus of NASA's research, is important. The military is important. Veterans affairs are important. You contrast him to Martha McSally, who also has a military background, but who now, as a serving senator, can really only wear the suits and, you know, professional dresses that most senators wear, and her message just gets lost. So her connection to those issues is really a lot more tenuous. She looks more like a Washington insider than she does like a recent veteran.
All right, now, nobody's ever going to come to me for fashion advice, but if someone who wore men's clothes said, hey, Rob, I need something for the Senate, I'd head him over to the suit section. For a woman, it seems like there's a lot bigger challenge figuring out what to wear. Am I wrong about this?
I don't know. I think that there are still a lot of choices, and a lot of people do express their personality even within the constraints of a suit. I mean, if you compare Susan Collins, who wears a lot of colors, but they're deep and dark, and they're in pretty traditional silhouettes, to Kamala Harris, who wears a really limited palette of gray and black, but who has like flounces and peplums and skirts and pants and mixes it up a little, there is some opportunity for expression. But frankly, once you're in the suit aisle, there's just not that many interesting choices.
Now, you also write about the desire to appear authentic when politicians are picking their clothes. And it seems like there can be some trouble spots there. People made fun of Al Gore wearing the earth tone sweaters, that kind of thing. Can people come off as insincere when they're trying to appear authentic?
Yes, I think there's a very fine line between looking authentic, and by that I mean consistent with your values and what you purport to stand for, and what you're wearing. So that line between authenticity and trying too hard can be really fine. If you look at Melania Trump's choices on her diplomatic visits, you'll see that she often misses the mark because she's trying to wear what she thinks people visiting that spot should look like. Right? Like, so her safari outfits when she was in Africa, they don't look authentic to her at all. They just look like she's a tourist with poor choices.
Do you have any thoughts on this new apparel item that we're wearing in 2020, masks? Have you seen much effort by candidates, if they're wearing masks, to really integrate them into their clothing story?
I think we're still at the leading edge of the mask fashion movement. And I think for candidates, that's something I would probably stay far away from. There's, again, a fine line between telegraphing your message through your clothing and literally writing it on your face.
Do you see the rules of political fashion changing at all over the last decade or so?
Absolutely. You see really interesting people like Kyrsten Sinema, the senator from Arizona, who wears whatever she wants on the Senate floor. And women in the House, for example, wearing, going sleeveless, which was previously verboten, or even Kamala Harris on the campaign trail in her Converse sneakers. We're really able to take more chances and be our true selves. And as long as we're doing that in a way that allows us to show what we really stand for, that comes across really well to voters.
And finally, in the presidential campaign, it seems like both candidates play it pretty safe in their suit choices. Is that fair to say?
I mean, how do we even notice their suit choices given everything else that's going around?
Very, very fair. Joellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Joellen Posner is an assistant professor of management and an organizational theorist at the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara University. She joined us today to talk about the messages that politicians at least try to send with their clothing choices. Coming up, we'll explore a list of Wisconsin women who have influenced their communities, the state, and even the whole world, a nationwide project going state by state doing this. We'll get the Wisconsin results. You can share your nominations. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, there's been a long-running argument about wolf conservation in Wisconsin, how many wolves there should be, whether hunting should be allowed, and more. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the latest news about wolves tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, 100 years ago, the 19th Amendment was formally adopted, and we've seen a variety of commemorations of women gaining the right to vote. The USA Today Network decided to write about influential women who made significant contributions to their state and the U.S. since that time. 10 women from each state and the District of Columbia were selected and written up as Women of the Century. We want to hear from you. Did you learn about women in Wisconsin history and the suffrage movement in school? Who are the women, past or present, who inspire you? Are there women who are leaders in your community? How have they influenced the life and the culture where you live? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Kathy Flanagan is a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter. She worked on the Women of the Century project and wrote the introduction for Wisconsin's list. We talked with her about the list this summer. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get to some of the women on the list, Kathy, can you talk about how this project came together?
Well, you know, Wisconsin actually was a year ahead of everyone else. So the Journal Sentinel had done some stories on how Wisconsin was the first state to let women vote. They did it in June of, 1919, but they did it in June of 19. And so we kind of went back at it in a different way. We had a group of women get together. We brought in a couple of women from the outside to talk with us. And we looked at who we thought was influential, who probably didn't get their due in other ways. And also we looked at people like, you know, everybody wants to say Oprah's from Milwaukee and she had some time here, but we knew that a lot of the women we looked at like Oprah were going to be claimed by other states. So we just started paring down from there.
And I imagine it was probably tough to pare down to just 10.
Oh, my gosh. And then since this is run, there are many, many more that probably could have been on this list as well.
Now, talk about the process and the group of people and what kind of things you weighed to get this sort of representative sampling of 10 women who were influential in Wisconsin since that pivotal date.
Well, there were about 10 of us at the table, as I recall, and everybody brought in an idea who they wanted, and they went from athletes to businesswomen to legislators, and we just looked at them. We talked about it a lot. We also talked, weighed where they were from and what their impact was in Wisconsin specifically, and that helped us sort of narrow it down a little bit. And then we sort of looked at, you know, what that means to women now.
We are talking to Kathy Flanagan from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at 10 of the most influential women in Wisconsin since women got the vote in the Constitution in the United States 100 years ago. Well, let's start meeting some of the people on the list. Vel Phillips is one. She's kind of in a category of firsts in Wisconsin. She was the first to do many things. We could talk about that. First, I want to listen to her. She's passed away, but we talked to her on Central Time back in 2014. Here's the voice of Vel Phillips encouraging younger people to choose a life of public service to make positive changes in the world.
If you know that what you want to do is to make a better city or state or United States and to write some of the wrongs, then you should hang in there and do it and not be swayed by the fact that it hasn't been done before.
Can you talk some about Vel Phillips' story?
Well, you know, Vel has a street now in Milwaukee, which is awesome. And she was the first African-American woman to graduate from UW-Madison Law School. She was the first to win a seat on Milwaukee's Common Council. She was the first to become Secretary of State of Wisconsin and the first to become a judge, not in that order. But she proposed the Fair Housing Law in 1962, and she wanted to make it illegal to not rent to Black people, and that was voted down 6 years in a row. It finally passed the Common Council in 1968. So, you know, she was tenacious, and she also marched with Father Grappi to walked the talk. Her name comes up often when you talk about somebody who is quintessentially Milwaukee. It's nothing but good.
I was listening back to the interview with her and reminded of the story and kind of how humble beginnings can lead to big things. She talked about how, you know, she'd been in a political organizing, a community organizing thing, and there had been a lot of talk about an election race for not her, but her husband. And as she put it, he chickened out and said she should do it. They used money that he had been saving up to buy her a mink coat. Mink coat was out. That turned into her city council campaign money. I mean, that the story of that and then her ending up on this list, I think, is pretty profound.
That's awesome. I mean, there were what I didn't know. I mean, I knew of Vel Phillips, but I've lived here 26 years, and I did not know, I hadn't heard of some of these women. And that doesn't mean that their contribution wasn't well known. It just means I missed it. It's my problem. All the women that were chosen were perfectly chosen for a reason.
Another one on this list, and I got to say, I only knew the name because she's been reported on by some of my colleagues here at WPR over the years, Dickie Chappelle, a.k.a. Georgette Louise Meyer, born in another Milwaukee connection here. Can you tell her story as a photojournalist?
Well, she was a photojournalist who known for her work as a war correspondent. So she covered Iwo Jima and Okinawa and then all the way to the Vietnam War. There are books about her. She's included in a book that a colleague of mine wrote, Meg Jones wrote. It was World War II Milwaukee. She sounds like an amazing person, and I wish I had met her. She died at age 47 on a U.S. mission in Vietnam. She was following behind a Marine, and he accidentally tripped a booby trap, which killed her. But before that, she'd been held as a prisoner by Russia for 60 days. And she was fearless. She was afraid of some things, but she still did it.
And one of the rare, I think you write in the piece, civilians who received military honors after her death.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I I'm trying to remember if I read this. I didn't find it today, but I think she met Castro at one time, and then she totally changed her mind about him after she saw how he ruled. But he had a specific name for her, and I want to say Spitfire, but that wasn't it either. He complimented her in her ability to go to war and to just not be worried about being the only woman somewhere, or that she was a woman and couldn't do what the men were doing.
And this is another common theme, I think, among many of the women on your list, and I'm sure many others who were close to making the cut, that they were often firsts or trailblazers or groundbreaking women in one way or another. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's very fair.
We're listening back to a conversation with Kathy Flanagan of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the USA Today Network's Women of the Century Project and Wisconsin's List. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a personal story or memory about any of the women we've talked about? What do their contributions mean to you? Are there other women you think should be on this list of notable Wisconsinites who made significant contributions to the state and the country? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to our conversation with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Kathy Flanagan, talking about commemorating the 100-year anniversary of women getting the right to vote and highlighting some of the biggest female names in the last 100 years of Wisconsin history. And we want to hear from you. How do you think about or commemorate women's suffrage? Do you feel like it's taught enough in school? Would you like to hear more about any of the women we've talked about so far? Who are the women who inspire you, past or present? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's bring on a caller now. Antonio is with us from Elgin, Illinois. Antonio, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Who'd you want to bring up, Antonio?
I hope that there's at least one Latina woman on the list, but I did want to suggest Christine Newman Ortiz, who has led the really important immigrant rights organization in Milwaukee for many years, Voces de la Frontera. Christine has really brought the issue of immigrant rights to the fore, and a third of Milwaukee's population is Latino. So I feel like she's been a really important contributor to not only Milwaukee's history, but Wisconsin's history, and has been an important female leader.
Antonio, thanks a lot for the call. As it happens, she is on the list, Kathy.
She is on the broader list. She's not on the top 10 list, but she definitely was on one of the people we put on our list to consider.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait, I think I read the list. Sorry. She is. I see it right here. I'm sorry. I knew we talked about her, but yes, absolutely. She's a great asset to Milwaukee, and we're lucky to have her.
Antonio, thanks a lot for that call. And there were other people involved in various types of civil rights movements on the list. Another person, another name, Ingrid Washanawatok, born in the Menominee Nation and founded the Indigenous Women's Network. Can you talk about her story a little?
Well, she became executor of the Fund of Four Directions, a philanthropic organization, and she worked to revive and promote indigenous languages. But I think her biggest claim to fame is serving on the committee as a committee chairperson for UN's International Decade of the World's Indigenous People. And she's also co-producing the documentary Warrior. I mean, she's became the face of indigenous people throughout the country. So that's such a part of Wisconsin history. And her death was honored by the Menominee Nation with a full warrior's funeral.
We've got some listeners emailing suggestions, some local, some statewide. Jeff in Superior says, Grace Pattison, wife of the mayor of Superior, who really helped build up the city. They built the Fairlawn Mansion and donated a lot of land to the city, some of which is in Pattison Park. You know, it'd be interesting. I bet there could be a lot of fun, Kathy, for people to do this at the local level.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, we've got some suggestions, too. In fact, one man wrote me, and he had a list of probably 12 people. And it includes people like Uta Hagen, who was a well-known actress, but also theater teacher. She taught acting teacher, or, from Charlotte Ray, who was on Facts of Life, to women who've done big, broad things that have helped their communities or the state or the world.
We also heard from Matt in Wausau, who emailed, like her or not, billionaire Diane Hendricks has had a lot of influence in our political discourse. She's been influential in her way. Thanks for that, Matt. And I think at the state level, certainly in politics, at the local level in Beloit, she's a household name for a lot of her development efforts there. Was she somebody who made the list of possibilities?
We discussed her. I'm from Beloit. So we discussed her and she did come up. I think we went with people who had that their touch was more national.
All right. Good. Thanks for the suggestion. And this is another kind of a statewide impact one. Chris in Adams nominates Shirley Abramson, former Chief Justice of Wisconsin's Supreme Court. So that's another case where probably this was somebody who had a statewide impact more than a national impact, I would guess, Kathy.
We did. We had a really long list, and it's quite impressive and makes you proud of being from Wisconsin. But we did sort of end up with a lot of people who had more of a national impact. But certainly, yes.
Maybe it's kind of unfair of USA Today to stop you at 10. I think that might be the problem here.
You know, it could go on. And you know what is spectacular is it's a growing list. It hasn't stopped.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Clara on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Clara.
Hi. I'm calling to recommend the name of Laurie Wynn, W-Y-N-N. Laurie was, as far as I know, the only black female to become head of the Wisconsin Education Association. She was a Milwaukee teacher, and she became head of the WEA. And it was during the turbulent times of this Milwaukee desegregation suit. And she played a vital role in not only the settlement of that suit, but as far as I know, she's the only black female that ever became head of the WEEA.
Clara, thank you so much for suggesting that. Now, I'm not your editor, Kathy, but it seems like there's a follow-up here where you do people of statewide influence. Would you be open to a pitch like that?
There is. If you look at a story we had, there is a place you can nominate people. So we are taking that seriously. We're looking at the people that we might have missed, but the people that everybody knows about that maybe we don't yet, that other people don't yet.
Thanks for that call. You can find the article and I guess make nominations at the website jsonline.com, the website of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Talking to Kathy Flanagan from the Journal Sentinel, looking at this commemoration of the anniversary of women's suffrage, looking at 10 influential women from Wisconsin over the last 100 years. I want to touch on a couple more names on the list who made these national or in some cases international impacts. And this is one, again, just because I'm connected to Wisconsin public media, I know the name Mildred Fish Harnack from Wisconsin, resisted Nazis in Berlin. Tell us that story.
So Mildred, who is a native, had gone to, I looked it up today. She's the only American civilian to be executed on the direct order of Hitler. But before that, she served 6 years of hard labor for crimes of treason and espionage. And there's a statue to her in Marshall Park. But it was a secret trial where Adolf Hitler had sentenced her to death. But she was married to she met a man in college at UW-Madison, and he was German. And they went back to Germany, and they were assisting Jewish people and others targeted by Nazis and essentially spying on the Nazi party, which is that's a brave, brave woman.
An amazing story. And now here's a name that I had heard of, and I didn't know about a Wisconsin connection until I read this article. Golda Meir, born Goldie Mabovich in Ukraine, ended up being a prime minister of Israel by way of Wisconsin, by way of Milwaukee. I didn't know that part of her story.
Her father came to New York first, but then he ended up coming to Milwaukee because he could get a job here. And after a year, he sent for his family. So she went to grade school here, and they credit her years in grade school and high school here with her ability to lead. For instance, she organized a fundraiser to pay for her classmates' textbooks, and she was always interested in teaching. And that's why there's Golda Meir School here. There's also the Golda Meir Library at UW-Milwaukee, before she became, of course, Prime Minister of Israel.
Yeah, so a lot of surprising connections that we find here in Milwaukee. You mentioned earlier you learned a lot that you hadn't known about people from Wisconsin. Has it given you an appetite to do more of this, Kathy?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, I had not heard of I'm trying to say her, Artie Clark Halyard. I know there's a Halyard neighborhood here, and I'm not sure. I would love to know if it's named for her, but I hadn't heard of her before. And she and her husband, she was born a sharecropper's daughter in Georgia, and she and her husband started a bank for African Americans because they weren't getting loans at the time. So they started Columbia Savings and Loan, and they helped African Americans buy homes, start businesses. And I find that incredibly amazing. And I hadn't heard that story, and I liked it.
You mentioned that athletes were in the conversation. One actually made the list from Wisconsin. I'm just getting to Gwen Jorgensen, who won Olympic gold in the triathlon. Were there other athletes that were in the running for the, if you will, for the final cut?
You know, we looked at some, but it really became more about, you know, it was a really competitive struggle. And, you know, I'm sure Bonnie Blair could have fit in here. But she also wasn't born in Wisconsin. So the struggle was real. And that's why Gwen Jorgensen made it, but not a lot of other athletes that come to mind.
Time for one more caller. Anne is with us in Madison. Anne, hi.
Hi. I was thinking of Stephanie Klett, who I believe was born in Beloit and promoted Wisconsin. That was her whole career, promoting Wisconsin in many ways.
She still promotes Wisconsin. She was Secretary of Tourism in the state for a long time. That might be a possibility again, Kathy, for those people influential at the statewide level.
Right. I think she's now promoting Lake Geneva, and she was on our big list.
Thanks so much for that call. So, Kathy, you're taking nominations, you said, for people for maybe a more Wisconsin-focused list. Is there a timeline? Could we be bringing you back in the future for another conversation like this?
I have to see where I'm not really sure how this is going to work. We just offered to let people tell us. And like I said, I've gotten some really good ones. So if I can round up these women I worked with again, it could probably happen.
Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kathy Flanagan is a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter. We talked to her about her work on Wisconsin's list of the top 10 most influential women in a century for a special USA Today Network feature commemorating the anniversary of women's suffrage. You can find a link to that list at Central Time WPR. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, big wildfires continue to burn on the West Coast. Kate and her guests look at fires and forest management in the midst of climate change. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then there's more traffic on some of Wisconsin's popular trails and state parks this year. We'll talk about what that means for the trails and for you if you're looking to get out there. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.